I am at the home of Don Woodruff in Eagle Village, Eagle City, Alaska, and I am now going to interview Don Woodruff for the Yukon Charlie Ethnographic Overview Project, which a university through the funding of the National Parks is doing right now. And one of the things that I have to let you know as a interviewee is that you don't have to answer any some of these questions if you don't want to. And this is just for the study of the Yukon Charlie as putting in a pamphlet for distribution. And what you say and what these things will do, it will be available to you probably prior to printing so that you can correct and give you the option of whatever. But it is just an overview of Yukon Charlie, and by coming in here, somebody can know what it is, where it's located, who the people are, and who the players were, the miners, the army, the native people, and the non-native people. So, Don, one of the questions that I will start off with is historical overview background. Where were you born?
California.
Were your parents born? Where were your parents born and grew up?
California.
Where were your grandparents born and grew up?
Italy and Ireland.
Where were your what can you tell me about the origin of your family, people, like you just told me, in Italy and Irish?
Irish,
okay.
Yeah.
So thank you. Are there any old beliefs, customs, traditions practiced by your family that remains important, that your soul might be willing to describe them?
Not that I'm aware of at this time.
What craft or other specialized activities do you do?
Craft?
Yeah. Arts and craft, I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Skin sewing. I do basket making. Birch bark basket making, sled building. That's pretty much that.
And
craft.
One of the things I may add here too is I knew Don for a long time, and that I knew that some of the things that he do is actually taken going back into the park system where the park is today, and back in the old days, these are some of the things that have been practiced. And you are one of the ones that is actually doing it and seeing that it stayed within.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is a good point, because a lot of many times people don't do that, you know. What crafts or how would you describe your identity, such as your beliefs, your ancestors, and your culture? And I think that we got that explained, that was explained up here. You said your grandparents are Irish and descendants of Irish. I think that in itself is good to know. What else do you identify with? What else do you identify with that defines yourself and your family?
Well, I think that the primary definition of our family is that we run dogs for subsistence purposes, fishing, hunting, gathering. I participated in local races, and I would think that that describes our family and the participation with the arts and crafts and the historical part of this Eagle area.
One thing I would like to add here too is that, like mushing and doing what Don does down in that area where he grows, is that a lot of the things that he is doing right now with his family is that these were the things that the native had years and years had practiced down in that area and utilized it. And one thing that I see is that it's mostly the non-native people who are doing these things now. And it is very important that we do elaborate a lot on this issue. And this is good because even if you talk about the old mail run, that is actually some of the land he probably even goes down on.
Yeah, I have a trap line on the
So you see, I see he could interact with, he knows that. And that is good. I do a community background. What do you know about Eagle's distant past?
Well, as a previous board member on the Eagle Historic Society, I've participated in the preservation of the Eagle Fort, some of the Eagle buildings, and general maintenance of the Eagle Historic Society and support and community functions in that respect.
It is interesting to note here too in that Eagle's historical past, especially with the military, back during the gold rush, the Klondike gold rush, I think because of the proximity of Alaska and the Yukon right next door, and that there was an influx of people coming into Alaska from that. And I always call those that didn't make it up there, they're the last one, the stragglers, I guess they call them, came down here. And the army at one time was the law that was killing a lot of that thing. That was their duty. That one of the, well, the telegraph too, but that was the other duty that they had. How have mining activities in that area affected life in Eagle?
Well, in the late 70s, I mined down in Coal Creek and was able to augment my income from trapping and subsistence activities. So I, for example, could buy an outboard motor or a new canoe and, you know, kerosene gas, chainsaw material.
Well, mining is the one that made Eagle. The tributary that Eagle out in the creeks, 70 mile, the just little creeks that come in up the highway, some of them discovered port, and even the American Creek and Michigan Creek. But I think most of our mining has gone on in the 70 mile itself, the grain itself, the 70 mile.
That's right.
Yeah. What role has the church played in the development of the Eagle?
Well, I think that there's positive and negative respects to the church. It can bring people together and it can polarize people. And my participation with the village church seems to be the most cohesive from my past experience.
Well, it is also interesting to know at one time that there was back at the beginning of the century, there was all kinds of churches here. There was a Presbyterian, there was a Catholic, and Episcopal. So you know that at one time these churches do may even still own land here in Eagle.
Yeah, the Catholic Church has property. Yeah. I think on Berry Street and Second Avenue.
So it wasn't just that one church, it was other churches.
Yeah.
What has the school played in the development of Eagle?
Well, the school in Eagle is a community area. They participate in community functions. It's not just a school for children, it's a school for the whole community. And without a school, no new families will move into Eagle, and it'll be a dying community if we don't have children and a school that happens to move.
Yeah, and right now, as small as the community of Eagle City and Eagle Village is, small, we find that it is a place where we can come and go, and there's little activity going on there that is very good for information-wise, you know.
Yeah.
How do you feel that life in Eagle has changed with the coming of new residents?
I think that there's always going to be change, and people that don't think that things are going to change are silly. But the flux, in other words, the coming and going of people is pretty balanced. And people come in with new ideas, and they get incorporated in the community, and the old ideas seem to be predominant.
I'd like to elaborate, but just one little note on that too is that there are people here in Eagle, and even in Eagle Village, that at one time or another opposed people moving in. But I think for the existence of Eagle, it is good that people do move in, because that's where your population comes from.
Yeah.
Whether it's young, whether it's the people that they call the river people at one time. But this is what a lot of our population is consist of. And, you know, Eagle is a seasonal community where we do a lot of things by the season. But yet, you know, we have an influx of very good number of people from all walks of life, you know. How do you think that tourism has affected the community of people?
Well, there's a positive aspect of tourism that's affected Eagle, is that it's generated a small amount of income for people that do crafts or public service stuff. I worked as a captain on the tour boat, for example. The negative aspect of that tourism is that we're basically in a fishbowl. People can come in, look at the way your life is pretty substantially just by walking through the community. And sometimes that has a negative impact on you.
What draws new residents to Eagle, and what causes residents to decide to leave?
The reason that people tend to leave is because they can't support themselves, or they're not happy with the fact that we are a remote community and there isn't access to, you know, movie theater shopping and the societal things. The reason people come into community is because of the quality of life that we have, and they respect the fact that we are at the end of a road, but yet we have pretty traditional values, and people are searching for that kind of history.
And the other thing too is that you're independentistic. You can be, you know. What is the opinion of leadership of Eagle, and what ideas might you have?
The opinion of leadership? Well, as a city council member, I just got elected to city council. I think that leadership in that respect is setting an example of the way you live and the way you interact with people, so that other people can see that that's proper or a correct way to live. And leadership in the city council, for example, is also listening to everyone's perspective and bringing that to the city council as a representative of the people.
I think just listening to you know, St. Hills, like you can do the What other historical events do you feel are important to Eagle's past?
other than mining history and the military history, the native culture is really strong in this community. And the traditional lifestyle that's associated with that.
On that question too, just to elaborate too, is that a lot of these people here, both communities, Eagle Village and Eagle City, do follow the season. There are certain times that they go fishing and they all go out there. A lot of sip nets, not very many fish wheels, but a lot of sip nets. The natives do it, the non-natives do it. And in the fall time, during the hunting season, they're out there trying to gather for their winter. And this is a pattern of life that still exists in Eagle. And I do believe that I would call that a very strong commitment.
Yeah, very strong.
Subsistence and employment. What kind of work have you done in the past while living in Eagle?
Well, I haven't really had many jobs in Eagle, except that I drove the Yukon Queen for 10 years, operated that tour boat. Most of my skills have been downriver subsistence skills, trapping, hunting, fishing. And so I haven't really had employment other than I went as a seasonal worker for Fish and Game down in the Dillingham Cape Center for the sonar project.
I think on number two on subsistence and employment in Eagle, you have already answered in a fair and little way, but how would you describe employment opportunities in Eagle?
I think that by my observation, there's a limited number of jobs for new people to come in and get. But when I go to the post office, I see two or three jobs posted, I would say 50 to 60% of the time. And that is an opportunity for people to get jobs if they want one.
I see as jobs in Eagle or anywhere else, and sometimes within the federal government mostly that I see, it is very hard to meet some of those criteria too.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of the local that don't have that background,
They aren't qualified. Yeah.
So I think at least too, you know, these are a very professional job skill. Like even a biologist or something like that, it takes certain certificate
yeah.
to get that.
Yeah.
You gotta be
That's
a
true.
Biologist. So I think in the long run that is very limited, you know. What does subsistence mean to you, and how do you participate in subsistence activities in the Eagle area?
Well, as a trapper, I get a good percentage of my income from trapping and selling my fur at auction. Fishing and hunting, I get probably 60-70% of my food, and gardening, I get a good portion of my vegetables, potatoes, and cabbages that I can put up for the winter. And just the general subsistence life, you know, I can take the dogs out and get firewood, and I can get my own water. So that's the needs of the community as far as I'm concerned.
When do you hunt, fish, trap, collect, and why at this time of the year? I believe that John already answered some of these as to what
Yeah, the only thing that I didn't specify was like gathering birch bark for basket making. That's a very specific time when the sap is running in the birch trees, and that's early in June.
Yeah.
And say through the month of June. On into July when the king salmon season starts and the fish start arriving here, the bark is much harder to harvest off of the birch trees.
How have state and federal regulations help or hinder your subsistence activities?
Well, other than the fact that you need to be a lawyer to read the regulations, you the state and federal hunting and fishing regulations are becoming more aligned, which means, for example, a caribou hunt, you need a state and federal permit system, whereas now things are moving more towards an alignment so that you only need one state or federal permit to hunt. It's a shame if you have to read the regulations and you can't understand them. And I think that's a big issue for a lot of people, is they don't know what to do when they go hunting. And perhaps they won't even go hunting because they do want to leave.
And one other thing that we might note here too is that, being that these are state or federal lands that we're talking about here, and at any time within that season for hunting, they have the thing that they can close it right
yeah,
now.
They can shut the fishing or hunting down. Yep.
So that's, we kind of, it doesn't bother us that much, but it's a consider. We consider some of those, you know, that could happen.
Oh, it can happen easily.
What ideas do you have for Eagle's economic stability?
Well, as far as new employment, I'm aware that the Eagle Sona, for example, which just started a few years ago, employs some people out of Eagle every year. Park Service employs people out of Eagle every year. But it's a very limited number. It might be two or three jobs per outfit, you know, and that's it. The village employs a couple people every year. But, you know, six jobs or whatever for a community of, say, 150 or 200 people is pretty nothing. And I don't foresee in the near future a bunch of jobs opening up, because the school population is not rising that much. It's not going to be more teacher jobs or teacher aid jobs. I don't see that the future for Eagle has a tremendous economic base, and that's why subsistence and traditional lifestyle is so important.
Do men and women do the same kinds of work in Eagle, or do they tend to be do different kinds of labor? How about in the past?
I think past and present, that their duties are pretty similar, and that I see, you know, women going out and get water and wood. But of course, the more physical aspects of a subsistence lifestyle is dedicated to the man and the family, and with the help of, you know, older children. But there's certainly duties that traditionally and in this community are separated by men and women.
Experience of flooding and climate change. Were you here in 1975?
No.
Can you tell me what the wind and weather was like?
What the weather was like?
And
well, I came in 1978, and as I recall, we never had ever any rain in the wintertime. Now, occasionally, we do get a rainstorm in the wintertime. That's a pretty big change from, say, 40 below to 40 plus on occasion in the wintertime. That's a big change. And I also see some game migration that wasn't happening back then that indicates there's more climate change. As far as flooding, I think that's just a day or a week of the year when it rains so much, or we get a real hot spell during the spring and we get a flood. I don't know that that's necessarily associated with global change.
Were you here in 2000?
Oh yeah.
Can you tell me what the land and weather was like?
I can't say that I documented the weather, except down on the trap line, we write down the weather every day on the calendar. But as far as the weather changing from then to now, I would say that there's some weather change, but I don't know that it's necessarily up or down.
I think one of the things too, is bouncing. I know, I think I would have had, when they're doing this, I would hear, one of the things that would come out is a year or two or four or two or five that we have to hire for the whole summer.
Right.
I think that was a big, big deal.
Well, millions and billions of acres burned. Yeah.
The guy once told me that there's 161 miles of the Taylor Island, and by looking at it, when he came in, that you can actually say 92 miles of it had burned.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah. Were you here during the flood of 2009?
Oh yeah.
What happened then?
Well, other than the community moving and trying to rescue a lot of things that were becoming floating and moving about and everything, the water came up above flood stage 50-something feet. So a lot of people's houses were destroyed, and the community store was destroyed, the gas station was destroyed, and it was devastating.
What do elders say about erosion, flooding, and storms?
Well, you got to think that the erosion, which basically from a major portion of it is from the river ice, during breakup, like it takes feet down from the banks. That's a normal spring function. As far as spring floods and rains, that happens, and it happened on the Taylor this year where it flooded the road out, washed out a bunch of the road. But I think most of that is associated with the fires, and that there's no root system to hold these hillsides down. And they, because of the fires, they just, with a good rain, they just come down and wipe the road out.
I think the old time, that one time, you used to call that slumping.
Slumping, yeah.
Yeah. How have the community reacted to flood in the past? Evaluation, moving home, protecting kids, elders?
Well, it's pretty well known that when breakup starts, that the potential for the ice to come over the bank. And so people generally get together and alert each other, and they stage boats, and they get ready. They get ready to be able to help each other.
That's one good commitment in Eagle in both communities that I see is that, like, we're small, but they do help each other in time of need. It's like some of these people are even up in their village, and sometimes they get separated from the town for some reason, when the town would make sure that they're okay.
Yeah.
And that's a good honor.
Yeah.
It's a close-knit family. Village, town. Do you notice changes in temperature, snowfall, rain, rivers, lakes, or ponds in the local area?
I think that those kind of temperature changes are subtle in this area. I don't see that there's a big vegetation change.
Please describe what the river and the region mean to you in practical and personal terms.
Well, the river is a highway. I mean, it's our link to subsistence, and we use the river for fishing, we use it for transporting goods back and forth, hunting and gathering, berry gathering, and communicating with our neighbors.
Part 4 will deal with the Yukon County National Preserve. What is your overall opinion of the Yukon Charlie River National Preserve?
Well, aside from this summer, when the law enforcement guys decided to get heavy-handed with the locals, it took a while, but there was a development of an understanding or a rapport with Park Service in the community. And we had a pretty good relationship with them, and we interacted with them well, the employees and the Park Service in general. After this summer, when the Park Service decided they wanted to arrest a few people, they destroyed that.
What has been the most positive thing about the preserve since its establishment?
My feeling is that the countryside is going to take care of itself. We don't need somebody walking around protecting the plants and the bushes. So I'm not sure that there's a large positive function that the preserve has done, except maybe to document history, some of the history projects that we have.
What has been the most negative thing about the preserve since its establishment?
The most negative aspect of the preserve is that it has the ability to limit people's access. And some traditional lifestyle practices are hindered and restricted by the Park Service. For example, recreational mining. People used to go out and get a little bit of gold, and they used that there for their subsistence. And now that's pretty prohibitive in the preserve.
And it may be interesting to note here too is that we can't go away from mining. Like he said, just the way he explained it, because mining was the things that put this area on the map for. Mining was the one that started a lot of these communities.
Yeah.
And we can't just say, well, we restrict it. Because you have to look at the fact that it was here long before.
Long early before the 1900s,
prior to that and all that, you know, so yeah. I mean, the restriction on that is very, very, people can't deal with that.
I worked at the gold mine at Coal Creek, which is now park headquarters down the river. I bet you couldn't dip a gold pan in the creek without being arrested.
How do you know? What do you know of people who have lived in the preserve since its establishment? And what was their opinion on the preserve? If you know and are willing to share this.
I've had a trap line down in the preserve for 30-something years and spent summers hunting and fishing down there. So I have a pretty good insight onto what people's opinion is of the preserve. And for the most part, people are pretty distrusted of the federal government. And since this summer, with their sort of badge heavy rangers, that trust is pretty much in the toilet.
It has opened up a lot of, I think the good word is trust. Like Don said, Don was involved with a lot of this issue of resolvement that Parks and the people in Eagle. And even the village had at one time. We were beginning to look at the situation where we can come together and discuss it. But as I see it, from my perspective, is that we're separating us again. You know, we almost built it. Now it's. Do you make use of the preserve for hunting, fishing, trapping, or any other activities?
All of the above.
What advice do you have concerning the preserve and its management?
One thing that we've been advocating all this year is that the preserve office set up an SRC, which is a subsistence resource committee, or some such thing, you can call it whatever you please, so that the Park Service has to and are forced to interact with the community and therefore build the trust, and we can discuss issues as they come up instead of all of a sudden arbitrarily they decide they want to throw people in jail for having a boat registration defunct. The boat's not register and all of a sudden they decide they're going to throw you in jail for that. We should know about that before it happens, instead of an after effect of people are, you know, handicapped, they miss their hunting period or whatever, like happened this last summer.
Can you describe the trails in the area, and what do you know about your use in the past and present?
What?
Trails.
The trails? Oh. Well, I know a lot about the trails around the Kanik area and the Charming River area because that's where I track the old mail trails and some of the trails up to 70 Mile, those access points into the backcountry.
The future of Eagle. When you think about the future of Eagle, what do you see?
Well, I think that it's not going to be that much different than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago.
Can you think about, and then list infrastructure you would want in the village or town?
Well, basic clean water for the community. We have had some issues with our city well, and the Eagle community and the school have issues with their well water. And if there's any one thing that the community could use, it's a really good, consistent source of clean water.
There has been a lot of talk about sustainability. Can you tell me what this means to you?
Sustainability, on a personal level, means to me that you don't go into debt more than you can pay for. Otherwise, you're in a backward motion. You work hard to get a good, say, background in your firewood gathering, your hunting and fishing, and participating with the community to help keep everyone informed about the resources that are available to us.
Are you interested in any alternative energy sources?
I have a solar panel that I use downriver to recharge some of the devices that we have there. Like a sat phone for emergency or whatever. And that works fine as long as there's sun, but a good part of the winter there isn't any sun, so to speak, the direct sunlight. So as that solar technology develops, I think that's going to be a good way to go.
Do you have any ideas about the future of Eagle and where it needs to go?
Well, I think that the future of Eagle is based on sort of the brotherhood of the community. In other words, when people share ideas and participate in community functions, it brings people together and that builds the community forward.
Okay, I just want to ask you, you have any questions? For me. I believe this is the end of the interview for this part, but I want to just on an at-ease type deal, ask a couple of questions about some of his activity that he practices. Just say the dog mushing, the trapping, the hunting, fishing, and stuff like that, and because I believe that we need to know all this too, you know, the actual day-to-day stuff like that.
Yep.
Would you mind?
No, I don't mind.
Okay, thank you. And let me turn this over to the paper. part of this ethnographic interview that I'm having with Don, I would just like Don to give you an idea of some of his activities that he has done and still practicing, which is to the causes of why Yukon Charlie was born.
Well, I know that some of the founders of Yukon Charlie, Randy Brown's father, Bill Brown, the historian, wanted Yukon Charlie to be a wild place that people could go and share with each other. And as a result of that, they set this land aside. The participation of people in a preserve in a subsistence fashion, I think, is very fascinating for people from that come into the area. For example, they're curious about how you fish, how you trap, and how you sort of eke out a living in not necessarily a day-to-day way, but a week-to-week or month-to-month. And for example, in July, generally the king salmon are coming and people are catching fish, sharing it with each other, and visitors from other parts of the world, and people putting up fish for the winter to preserve it. And the same thing in August for caribou and September for the moose. So it's a month-to-month existence. And then in the winter, we have our dogs that we can go out and get our drinking water out of the creeks. We can harvest timber out of the woods to heat our homes. So it's, you're very much in touch of how your daily life functions around subsistence. I mean, when your sled breaks, if you don't build your own sled, you have to get somebody else to fix it. If you build your own sled, you can just build a new one or just prepare it easy to buy.
It may be interesting to note too at this day, for this statement is that the national parks in Alaska were formed under the Antiquities Act, were established under that. But if we note that there may be a provision within the Alaska Native Land Claim, Section D2, that states that some of these lands will be set aside and withdrawn for all these federal government, wild and scenic, national preserves, national parks, and even the federal waterways. So it's not just the act that did it, it was in 1971. That's, you know, people don't realize that it's in the Native Land Claims Act.
So one of the things I know that Anilka did was it set this land aside in a preservation manner. And it was the final statement on setting land aside. And it mandated that the government don't continually set aside rivers and wild scenic areas over and over and over into the future until we can't go and use those areas. It was the final statement. This is what we're going to do. And it seems to be that the BLM and the Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service are always looking to set aside more and more areas as wild and scenic areas. That should have been the end of it.
I have to say that even though I have worked with regulations, state statutes, and federal opinions and Supreme Court opinions, these are very, very hard to understand. And any given person out here, you don't understand it.
Yeah.
You can't begin to. So I think there lies some of the problems before we even exist what we're going through. You know, the reason why I had a grasp on a lot of this is I did a lot of work in the pre-Anilka or implementation of a lot of that, and I did a lot of the work within the native land, you know. Yeah. But it is still complicated.
Yeah. I got a letter just from the governor to the city council that stated that Anilka set aside this land, and it was the final statement on setting aside all wild and scenic areas. And that should be the end of it.
I still have to say whether park or just an area with a designation of an area is that this land has for centuries was used by the people for a specific. And like you stated earlier, it took care of itself.
Yeah.
And I still think that whether it's grandfather in or whether it's in your inherited right, those things should be gone. Those things should be practiced.
Yeah, I think that the people that do subsistence, participating, hunting, fishing, gathering, they are the best stewards of the land because they see that the future is for their children, their grandchildren to participate and be conservation minded.
It is very hard sometimes if you even look at some of the questions that Don answered, is that how can you ask a question as to how you curtail certain activities when at another given deal within the law that you can't do these things.
Oh yeah.
And so I mean, it's very hard on people.
Yeah.
And it's really a, like I told Don last night, that it's catch 21, it's catch 22, you know? You be damned if you don't, and you be.
Yeah, I know that there's going to be a lot of restrictions on people fishing this year, because we're not meeting our treaty obligations in Canada, you know? And that's going to be a hardship for everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things too is that's not the only thing that's coming down, is that time in itself is upon us right now, where it's going to affect everybody, whether it's hunting or fishing or trapping, but other necessities for us to get by out there in the remote areas, you know. We are in the rapid rising, growing economy. I mean, where the society is, you know, it just keeps going. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, there are going to be a lot of people that will survive that, and unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of people that's not going to survive also, you know. And this is the good of it, is that those people that know how to use the land or knows how to do certain things for yourself, for your survival, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, what do you, since you came into the country, what do you think the gain, news tell you, what do you think the decrease and everything there before? What did you look at like?
I know the moose population back in the 70s was much higher than it is now. And for whatever reason, it's not just human predation. I think it's the whole picture of outside hunters coming in and taking as much as they can, and wolf and bear predation on young, you know, cows and calves. I think that's the predominant decline in this population. I think that's the same thing that we've been hearing as well.
I've looked at some of the graphs and some of the documentation of the 20-mile network, and although we live and we reside here, the locals we would call for people 20 miles, it's so absurd for me to see that the non-residents are getting more, not the non, the the outsiders coming in, the Anchorage Fairbanks people are getting more than what we are getting.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? The difference, you can see that.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, it's plain.
Yeah. And according to state law, I mean, the resources for everyone.
Yeah.
And everyone should have a reasonable opportunity to harvest sufficient wildlife. But the people that are custodians of the herd, the people that live around the population where the herd functions, they should be the primary resource.
Yeah. And I know too, you know, sometimes you have 10 days to leave, and I've seen that these are interchangeable, right? They interact with another substance activity. And sometimes some of these people will fish for their dogs during that time or prior to that time.
Yeah.
And sometimes you got to devote that and you miss it. You missed it.
That's right. If you're fishing, you can't be hunting.
That's right. So I noticed that a lot of strong points in there that have been voiced, you know, and Don does serve on the 40-mile campus. I guess the rehabilitation of building it up again, huh?
Yep. It's a good success story of an international committee getting together and setting up harvest parameters that are building the herd, and it's soon to be 55,000.
It
started out at 5,000.
And it needs to be, too, you know, that they have a leverage. They can't set the proposed regulations to official game or to the other committees prior to going to that official game. But it is also good that if they want to, for the good of the 40-mile caliber, if they want to, they can put in there that we forego a season two or we don't come to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have all the levers to control that destiny of the caliber.
If you think about the honor of the people in Canada around Dawson, they are putting their harvest quota back into the herd.
Yeah.
That's a very honorable function.
Well, you know, right now I see you know, it's up, but it's not. I mean, I can't even begin to say good or bad or whatever you think. But you know, I think that the 40-mile caliber was the herd that lived in right here.
Oh yeah,
and
in fact, the historical range for that herd went to Whitehorse in the winter time. And now it's unusual that they even see any in Dawson. So if we can build that herd even half to its old historic range, I think it's a great success story.
Yep. And I think too, you know, that this comes this group that Don is working with, you can go and talk to them or anything, and your voice will be forwarded to the group. Because they'll listen to everybody.
Oh, yeah,
whether it's a good something, I guess, the hunting, somebody that's for the hunting, somebody that's for just a local, whatever. But the state of access, natural resource, and the non-renewable resource, the less people. I am really sometimes looking at statistics. Statistics give me an idea of what has been missing or what has been more gone after or something like that. And if you really help me and begin to see some changes or some good points. But I don't know, it's really that I see the big time game guys, game is where you don't notice it, but it does go on.
Oh yeah. Well, the thing about those big game guys is they have a pretty limited harvest because their clientele is looking for a special size animal, big rack, maybe a unique,
so it's a unique
function, like the phantom sheep, for example. Mm-hmm. There's very few people that guide those phantom sheep. That's a resource that, if it was well known to other places in the world, there'd be a lot more hunters.
Yeah. It is also interesting, you know, is that there's phantom sheep down in, I think, this area here is probably the only place where it's,
they're known. Yeah.
That they're here.
Yeah. They're here from like 30 miles downstream on the Yukon to 30, 40 miles upstream, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. And then Bloody Mary is right at the border of Canada.
Yeah.
I think when you look at the overall good of the country, there are still some good stuff out there, and there are still some the bad stuff. I mean the good and the bad that still try to outweigh itself in that balance back up. But I remember days when I say we used to rush from Eagle to Circle, or Eagle to Circle in the fall time, and that's when we set up for the winter. You never hear that anymore.
Yeah.
People were always on the land. And I mean, right now, you're pretty well limited. You're limited.
Yeah.
To do it.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Well, I think there's still room if people want to go and set up a trapping camp or a hunting camp and just go spend a month. I think there's still plenty of room to do that. It's just that the consciousness of Eagle community is that it's more of a base. People work out of it as a base rather than going to some place like the Canandaigua Nation and use that for a base.
You know, I haven't done any trapping for saying that I go out there. I haven't done it, but I did. I was involved with my dad with one evening, and sometimes I remember that. And Don can tell you that that's a damn good excuse. It is a good. I mean, it's
a good lifestyle.
Good lifestyle.
It is.
I mean, it's happy.
You have to be very resourceful.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the thing that I always hear. You can't do certain things because you're out in the village, but what I've got to really say, and Don can verify, is that those people who go out and do these things is for their survival, and they're a bunch of and one of the last things I like to describe when you enter that is especially the people that still do these things. I mean, I have to give them all the credit for it. I mean, it's tough life out there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole science to maintaining your dogs and breeding your dog team up so that you have a good line of dogs that can actually do all the work you have to do.
You know, the concern is, oh well, you know, they got this and they got that. They live out there. Some of them that do these things, they live out there, and sometimes they're by themselves.
Oh yeah.
And there's a concern of just your personal well-being of you and your dog. That's your number one. And I just like to say too is that you know it. It's a good life, and it's also tough. But those people that do it, you know, they don't do it because they supplement their income. Yes, but they also enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle.
Yeah. Because I don't want to go on a dog sled runner any more than I have to, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, it's a good feeling. You have accomplished quite a bit, or you came to that. I would say that you're still practicing those activities and those seasonal things that what they meant to be for that, you know, kind of game. You got any more to add on that?
No, I think that just to emphasize that the people on the land are the best stewards of the land.
Yeah.
That's important.
One of the things I would like to say on that one too is that the best stewards of the land is that when I do a lot of what they call the traditional knowledge type deal, and I put into one of my presentations last time that, like John put it in that book, on the land of best known as land, I said, traditional knowledge is widespread, that it is also each different nationality has their own traditional knowledge, and traditional knowledge is applied through word of mouth, the learning, the, and when I say that, who else knows the habitats and the ways of animals and the herbarium and those people that live out there with them, and these people are the best information on that source. So I always said that traditional knowledge on that and that thing is one of the best things to look like, you know, whether it's simple or hard. Traditional knowledge is, we'll talk about that later. Well, I just want to say thank you, Don, and I think this is going to be a good interview, because I wanted somebody to understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Not only to say, well, he's just another guy that lives in Eagle.
Yeah.
But you are doing it. What you're doing, it's not because you want to do it. It's because it's what you like, and you will keep practicing it.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And it only supplements a little bit of your income, but, you know, what better way to say that I love doing what I do?
Yeah, that's right.
And I just want to thank you again, Don, for taking the time to spend with me. And I'll get you a copy of this, and before it goes out into any kind of a form, I give it to you for corrections or anything that you think we missed, you know.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.